from somewhere out there. This is Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
Tonight on Coast to Coast, an extraordinary real-life tale exposing international intrigue, corruption, and little-known government and corporate activities that have dire consequences for American democracy and the world. In a moment, economic hitman John Perkins on Coast to Coast AM. John Perkins has lived four lives. He's been an economic hitman, a CEO of a successful alternative energy company, an expert on indigenous cultures and shamanism, a teacher-writer who used his expertise to promote ecology and sustainability while continuing to honor his vow of silence about his life as an EHM, and a writer who, in telling the real-life story about this extraordinary dealing as an EHM, exposing the world of international intrigue and corruption that is turning the American Republic into a global empire despised, he says, by increasing numbers of people around the planet. Our guest tonight on Coast to Coast AM, John Perkins, whose book has very quickly become a New York Times bestseller. John, how are you?
I'm great, thank you. It's great to be here, George.
My pleasure. I do want to ask you this. On the back cover of your book, you have a quote from Johnny Mack, Harvard professor. Is that the same Dr. Mack that we know so well, who passed away when he was hit by a car in England?
It certainly is.
Oh,
yes.
My God.
He was a good friend of mine and a supporter of the work I was doing. Yes, he's dearly missed, isn't he?
Yeah, it's a very sad story. Not only in, I'm sure, the circles that you are in, but the type of circles that he was in also when he was doing the alien abductions and issues like that. He was a great man.
But, you know, I have to tell you, I was going to attend his birthday party at his house, and it was just a few days after he died. We had a party anyway at his house in Cambridge, Massachusetts, a celebration. And there was a Native American who many of your listeners may know, a man named Sequoia.
Yes.
There, who was a good friend of John Mack's. And he was called upon to sort of open the evening. There were quite a few people in the house. And Sequoia said that he had journeyed to John, and John was in a very good state. It was his time to go. He went before he actually was hit by the car, so he didn't suffer. It was a very touching, a very moving moment, I have to tell you, and that there's nothing that we should be sad for. We should celebrate his life. That's the important message here, is to celebrate his life.
Yeah, I knew when I was reading your book and then looked at the back, I said it's got to be one and the same.
Mm-hmm. It's
got to be. And so be it. Economic hitman, a compelling story. I guess one can now call you a whistleblower, can't they?
Well, I guess you could. I'd rather think of myself as kind of a reformer. But I certainly blown a whistle in a way, I suppose, too.
You, I guess, decided to go public with this story, Confessions of an Economic Hitman. How come?
9/11 is the short answer. It's a story that I'd started writing this book five times previously, and each time I've been convinced not to write it. Then on 9/11, I happened to be in the Amazon on 9/11 with indigenous people there, whom a nonprofit I founded worked closely with. But shortly after that, I came back and I went up to New York to Ground Zero. And as I stood there looking down into that terrible, tragic, smoldering pit, I realized that I had to take some responsibility for what had happened there. That some of Ground Zero is about the tremendous anger around the world at this empire that we've created and the way we exploit people. And I was certainly part of creating that empire and setting this up. And I also realized that I owed it to the American people to come clean on this, that I owed it to my daughter, who is now 22 years old, that the American people really need to know what's going on in the world, because most Americans believe that foreign aid is primarily altruistic, and in fact, a great deal of our foreign aid just goes to making some of our wealthiest people even wealthier, and a few collaborators in the third world, the developing countries, wealthier also.
there are going to be some people who are not going to like what you have to say tonight. They're not going to like some of the things that you have written about in your book. How would you address them when the time comes and we open up the old phone lines?
Well, I personally don't think there's anything. It's not about liking or disliking. I tell the story in the book of my life as an economic hitman and what I did and what this country is doing to a certain degree. And I tell it because I'm a very loyal American, because I know we can do better. I come from over 300 years of Yankee Calvinists up in New Hampshire and Vermont. My relatives have fought in every major war this country's fought, including the Revolution. I wrote this book because I want us to get better. I want our children to live in a safer world and our grandchildren and a better world. And I think that we've strayed very far from the true American ideals of government of the people, for the people, by the people, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness for everyone. I think we've really strayed from that since World War II. It started innocently enough, but it's become a little less innocent. I want to change that, and the book really just tells the story of what I've lived. So, whether people will like it or not isn't really an issue to me.
Right.
It's I hope people will understand it and realize that I have a tremendous hope that we are now in a position in this country and in the world to really create something new, something beautiful that truly reflects the idea. The ideals of the Republic, which we all believe very strongly in.
And without a doubt, while you were an economic hitman, and I'm going to ask for that definition in a moment, you did make a lot of money doing this, did you not?
Yes, as an economic hitman, my primary goal, I talk in the book about how I was recruited by the National Security Agency, and they put me through a number of tests, including lie detector tests, and discovered my weaknesses. And one of those was to live the good life. I'd grown up quite poor in rural New Hampshire. And more than actually becoming wealthy, what I wanted was to travel first class, to fly on the top of the hump in the 747, to stay at the best hotels around the world, eat at the finest restaurants, hang out with beautiful women. They gave me that. And I was beginning to get rich. I was the youngest partner in the 100-year history of the firm I worked for. And I was just on the verge of seeing myself becoming a millionaire before I reached 40 when I had an epiphany. I was in the Virgin Islands at the time, and I realized that I had to get out of the business before I really got rich or I'd be stuck in it. And that's the point where when I quit. So I can't say I actually ever became wealthy in the business. I made a very good living, and I traveled and lived the dream that I had had when I was much younger growing up in rural New Hampshire.
The phrase economic hitman, what is that?
Well, we economic hitmen have really been the ones who've built the first truly global empire in the history of the world, George. And we've done it primarily through cheating the developing world and our own U.S. taxpayers out of trillions of dollars, essentially funneling that money from organizations like the World Bank into the private sector, into the hands of some very rich people in this country and in other countries. And we do this in many different ways, but perhaps the most typical way that we do this is that we economic hitmen will identify a developing country that has resources we covet, for example, oil.
Okay.
And we'll go to that country and arrange for a huge loan from the World Bank and its affiliates. But most of the money from that loan never gets to the country. Instead, it goes to banks in San Francisco or Houston or New York or Chicago to pay companies that you've heard about, like the Bechtels and the Halliburtons and the Stonehenge.
All right. We sure have.
Yeah. To pay these companies to build big infrastructure projects in the developing country. Now, these are projects like power plants and industrial parks and ports that primarily serve the very rich in those countries and leave the country with a huge debt, one that it can't repay. So at some point, we go back to that country and we say, look, you know, you owe us a lot of money. You can't repay your debt. So give us a pound of flesh. Sell our oil companies your oil real cheaply, or provide land for military bases, or vote with us on the next critical UN vote, or something like that. In essence, we've used this method to create a world empire. It's been created largely, for the first time in history, an empire has been created largely without the military.
Now, are we creating a world empire, or are we creating stability?
Oh, we're not creating stability at all, as 9/11 proved, as the fact that every time we walk into an airport and have to go through that tremendous security system proves, as the fact that we've got many young men and women right now in Iraq and in Afghanistan and still are not winning in those wars. We've done the opposite of create stability. It's a more dangerous world now than it was 30 years ago. And that's really why I wrote the book. I want stability. I want my daughter to grow up in a safe world, in a world that is truly compassionate, that truly reflects the American ideals. And when we create that world, when we try to foster for people around the world our ideal of government for the people, of the people, and by the people, then we'll have a stable world. But only then. All these stopgap measures of security forces and military is not going to create a stable world for us.
John, how long has this formula of economics been going on, where they would go to these underdeveloped countries, plop these billions of dollars of loans on them, and then force them, to basically, give us some of your resources, your assets, and we'll look the other way?
Well, George, the process that we use that I've described is really about as old as history, but we've perfected it, and we've really perfected it since World War II. And I think I mentioned earlier that I believe it started innocently. The roots to this really go back to World War I, and if you look at World War I and the Depression and World War II, you see that my father and mother, for example, grew up in a very terrifying world, very unstable world, and as did my grandparents. They came through World War I, the Depression, and World War II. At the end of World War II, the decision was made to try to change this, to try to take more control, and organizations like the World Bank and the IMF and the other so-called Bretton Woods organizations were created at the end of World War II to help reconstruct the devastated parts of the world that were devastated by World War II, Europe and Asia particularly.
Sure.
Now, these organizations did a pretty good job at that, but they immediately became politicized, because at that point we saw a new enemy on the horizon, a terrifying one, Russia, the Soviet Union. And, of course, they had nuclear weapons, as did we. So this was very terrifying. So as part of the process of reconstructing the world, these organizations like the World Bank also took upon their shoulders the task of proving to the world that our system, capitalism, was better than the Soviet system of communism. And so they immediately became politicized. And as time went on, that became more and more so. Part of becoming politicized meant promoting capitalism, which meant promoting U.S. corporations. So these organizations very quickly fell into that rut of really championing U.S. and other corporations. By the time detente came around, we'd already reached a point where we weren't nearly so concerned with showing up with the Soviet Union as we were in just promoting our corporations. The system really became corrupted over the 50 plus years since World War II.
Okay, are other countries doing this too?
Yes, we're certainly not alone. But I would say we're really like the quarterback and the coach combined of this team. As a measuring stick, out of the 100 largest economies in the world, 51 of these are corporations, not countries, corporations, and 47 of those are U.S. corporations. So you can see we're really, we're the leader, we're the CEO, or the quarterback, the coach.
Now, is this being done with the mandate of government, or are we talking about these globalists that exist throughout the world, who have this power hang-up, who have this greed and money hang-up? Are they the ones who are controlling these purse strings through these banks and this design, this plan, and we'll get into it with you tonight, is designed to make them more powerful, more richer?
Yeah, that's really it, George. You really hit the nail on the head here. I mentioned that it's several unique things about this empire. It's first truly global. One was created primarily without the military, and the third unique characteristic is that there is no emperor, there's no king. Instead, we have what I call a corporatocracy, which is really it's three pillars, the heads of the big corporations, big banks, and government. And these people are constantly jumping back and forth between these. So at the very top, you can't even hardly make a distinction. You know, the people like under the Democratic regime, we had Robert McNamara, who was president of Ford Motor Company, and then Secretary of Defense under Kennedy and Johnson.
Yeah, who freely admitted that our involvement with Vietnam after the fact was a disaster.
Right. And he became Secretary of Defense and then president of the World Bank. And today, of course, we've got people like Dick Cheney and Condoleezza Rice who jump back and forth between these various sectors. So at the top of this heap, the corporatocracy is made up of men and a few women who are in flux between, you know, officially working for corporations and government and banks. And in fact, what they're doing in all of this is promoting the corporatocracy. And the real power and wealth of that corporatocracy rests within the corporations. But again, there's a very fine line, almost an invisible line, between the corporations and the government at the highest level.
Is it safe to assume, John, that whenever we go into a country to change it, either militarily or through our own plan of economics, that the mission to oust someone, like a Noriega, like really anybody that we've ousted, is based primarily on the fact that for that moment, they decided, those people, not to play ball with us, and so they had to go.
That's absolutely true. That's been my experience time and time again. And I talk in the book about Panama and particularly Noriega's predecessor.
Who was on the CIA payroll, by the way, was he not?
Noriega was.
Absolutely.
Yes, and I think everybody's admitted to that. But he made some critical mistakes in terms of really irritating, angering the corporatocracy. So they had to get rid of him. This around the world, what we've seen in my lifetime is that the corporatocracy will support violent, brutal, bloody dictators if they support the corporatocracy. And we will throw out democratically elected governments if they don't support the corporatocracy. And we've thrown out democratically elected presidents in Chile and in Iran and in Panama and Ecuador and Guatemala, in many, many places around the world, and we've supported bloody, brutal dictators who are totally undemocratic, also in places like Iran and Saudi Arabia, Iraq. We supported Saddam Hussein for a long time, again, and in Chile, after we got rid of Allende, we supported Pinochet, and in Paraguay, and many, many other places. It's very unfortunate that we do this. And that's what's angering so much of the world. That's one of the things that's angering so much of the world.
So the modus operandi is not based on humanitarian moves that you would think governments would want, but it's based primarily on the greed and economics and the motives.
Absolutely, at the highest levels. And I need to be clear on this, that there's an awful lot of people working within these organizations, and any of the ones that I've mentioned, and many others in the government and so on, they're working very, very hard and are very idealistic and are in favor of humanitarian policy.
You might want to say that again, John, because sometimes people have a tendency not to hear things like that.
Okay. Yeah, I do want to make that very clear, that there's many, many people, hundreds of thousands of people working in these organizations, including the Bechtels and the Halliburtons and the World Bank, that are very dedicated and very hardworking people and very idealistic, who want to see humanitarian causes go forward, and have had the wool pulled over their eyes as to what we're doing in the world. But at the highest levels of these organizations, those people are very clear on what's going on. And they're part of the corporatocracy.
Are we talking
There's an important distinction, George, and I appreciate your wanting me to emphasize that.
Absolutely.
There's an important distinction between the American people and even the workers in government organizations and corporations and the policies at the top of those institutions.
Well, hopefully by the time this interview is done tonight, John, you will let us know just how much money some of these corporations, maybe some of these individuals, are pocketing by some of the things that are going on right now or some of the things that have gone on. We'll be back in a moment with our guest, John Perkins, Confessions of an Economic Hitman. And I got to tell you, after reading this book, he's lucky they don't have a hitman chasing him. We'll be back in a moment.
Networks presents Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
Well, if you're still interested in the After Dark CD, well, go ahead. Let me give you a website and a phone number where it's a double CD where you get 2.5 hours of bumper music, some of the classic phone calls to the show, and ghost stories. Go to www.afterdarkcd.com or call this toll-free number, 1-800-598-2331. 1-800-598-2331. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie with our guest, John Perkins, Confessions of an Economic Hitman. John, tell me a little bit about what you did, your responsibilities, your job.
Well, I ended up having a staff of several dozen people, close to 50 people, and my title was chief economist. And
for
a company called Charles T. Maine out of Boston. And incidentally, this whole operation, now, I was recruited initially by the CIA, by the NSA, the National Security Agency, the nation's largest and probably least understood spy organization. These days, economic hitmen, like the CIA-sanctioned jackals, the assassins in the process, all of us are employed by private agencies, as far as I know, entirely. The days of the 007s, the government agent licensed to kill, are long gone if they ever existed. Today it's all done through private contractors, which gives a certain amount of protection to the government.
Who are funded by taxpayers, no doubt.
Oh, yes, where, you know, either private corporations are under contract to, you know, well, there could be the Defense Department or the State Department or USAID, or sometimes it's the World Bank, which isn't necessarily U.S. government funds, but a great deal of it is funded by U.S. taxpayers. And certainly in the case of the jackals, the assassins, that is funded by taxpayers. So my official title was chief economist for Charles T. Maine, and between me and my staff, I suspect the we worked in most of the countries around the world that have resources that we covet. Personally, I was involved in places like Indonesia and Iran and Egypt and Saudi Arabia, And Ecuador and Colombia and Argentina and Venezuela, you name it.
You did that. Okay, so what did you do? What did you and your staff do?
Well, as I mentioned before, typically what we did was set up these deals where we would identify countries that had resources that we coveted and arrange these loans, and then develop projects which would be use these loans to hire American companies to build these projects, which would primarily benefit the wealthy in those countries. That was the most typical example. Now, there were exceptions in countries like Panama, where it was the canal that we were interested in, and Saudi Arabia, which didn't need loans because it had so much oil, so we had to go about it in a different way. So we used a different approach. But in every case, what our work was about was funneling money into U.S. corporations and making those countries dependent upon us, basically bringing them into the empire, if you will, in a very different way from when the military forces created empire. We did it a different way, but it had the...
On one aspect, I'm going to talk about the corporations in a second, but on one aspect, what's wrong strategically than having other countries dependent on you? I mean, I'd rather have a country dependent on me than dependent on China, for example.
Well, you're absolutely right in that, George. And I think really there's a couple of things that are wrong here. First of all, I think what's wrong is that we're doing this very clandestinely so that the American people are not aware that we're doing this. You know, when you build an empire based on a military, everybody knows you're doing it.
You can see it.
Yes, and your own people know because their sons are the ones going off to war all the time. When you do it using economic hitmen, it's much more secretive. And the second thing that's wrong here is that we think nothing about supporting bloody dictators, ruthless regimes, as long as they fit within our scheme. And we think nothing of overthrowing democratically elected regimes if they go against us. That, to me, is very wrong. It goes totally against what the people of our country believe in and want. And it also goes against all our most sacred documents, like the Declaration of Independence, our Constitution, and our Bill of Rights.
Now, are we funneling billions of dollars to these U.S. corporations this way through taxpayer money? And then these fat cats are getting richer?
That's absolutely true, yes. It's not all taxpayer money by any means. A lot of the World Bank money comes from the open market. In other words, they get the money through, the open money markets. But a great deal of it is the U.S. taxpayer money. It depends on where it's coming from. When it comes from organizations like USAID, it's U.S. taxpayer money. In any case, I have to say that even when it's not U.S. taxpayer money, we suffer greatly in this country. The people that are being ripped off are people around the third world and U.S. taxpayers and citizens, because we've created a world that is very angry at us. And most Americans don't realize this.
No, they don't. And let me tell you, honestly, by half of my... I get a system here where they can send the instant messages, and half of them are so ticked at you, they want me to get a noose and string you up. Mm-hmm. The other half thinks the world of you, but there's no middle ground here. I've not seen one message that says, hey, this is an okay show. They either hate you or they love you. And unfortunately, I think that's what's happening to this country. It's right down the middle that way. It's divided that way.
Yeah, and I don't think anybody should either hate me or love me in this regard for these things. I'm simply telling the story of what I did in my life. And people can hate what I did and work to change it, or I suppose they could love what I did and say, well, it's a good thing that he did it, and he's telling his story, and so be it.
Well, let me read you just a couple, just because it's good for the perspective of our interview tonight. You're going to be with me for a long time. It says, John Perkins is a patriot. He is warning us, like Ike did, to beware of the military-industrial complex. So that's one. That's a good one for you. It says, you've done it. You've managed to fit my low spirits with bringing in John Perkins as your guest. I'm a graduate in economic studies. Thank you. I'm not lonely anymore. Another guy. This is liberal bull, four-letter word. I'm switching. I don't like this guy. I'll listen tomorrow. So it's split. It's amazing.
Yeah, and you're right. I mean, this is what's happening to the country. I tried very hard in writing the book, and before anybody else switches, I'd ask them to please read the book because it goes into a lot more detail, and I very clearly make the point that this is not a partisan issue. What I'm talking about here happens under Democrats and under liberals, as well as under Republicans and under conservatives.
And I think what you're trying to point out, and it's so important that we get to this, is you are trying to point out that there are people in this country who are profiting on taxpayer money for the ills of some of these countries.
That's exactly right, yes. And that we Americans don't want that. We're a very compassionate people. But we believe in some very high ideals, very important ideals. And we need to make sure that those who are running our corporations and our government maintain those ideals, and that our image around the world reflects who we truly are and what we truly believe in. And what I'm saying is what's happened in the last several decades has really tarnished that image and has hurt a lot of people. 24,000 people, George, die every single day from lack of nutrition. 30,000 children die every single day from lack of medicines. They die from curable diseases. Now, we could alleviate a great deal of that. And in fact, our policies, and to some degree, I'm sad to say, foster that sort of a situation. The families of these people are very, very angry, and their neighbors are angry. People around the world, for the most part, in many countries that we consider to be uneducated, understand what's going on. Even if they can't read the papers, they hear the radios, they talk to friends, they know that billions of dollars are being lent to their country. And they see American companies in there building huge projects. And they see a few of their own people becoming very, very wealthy, and yet they know that their lives are getting worse off. Their kids are going without food, without sanitation, and we're prospering in the process. They're very angry about this. Unfortunately, many of our people don't see this. I hear so frequently people say things like, well, we give these people so much money, we're so generous with our foreign aid, how can they hate us so much? Well, the fact of the matter is, we're not giving them very much money. There are exceptions, like after a tsunami, immediately after a big natural disaster, we do give them money. But for the most part, the foreign aid that most of us believe is going to help people is not going to help those people at all.
Well, and you know what bothers me, John, is, and I'm going to speak frankly too, as an American, if what you say is true, and you're telling me this was one of your jobs, this is what you did. You know, we've got truck drivers who listen to the show, who are busting their tails to make a dollar to support their families. We've got police officers, we've got nurses, we've got teachers, we've got people who work in fast food stores trying to make $5 an hour or less. And what you're telling me tonight is that there is this group, let's call it the Illuminati for lack of a better word, that controls purse strings, corporations, banks, and they don't care about people. They don't care about people in this country. They don't care about people on this planet. All they want to do is control, make money, and have power. And if that's true, if what you tell me is true, to me, it's disgusting. Absolutely disgusting that there are people out there that would manipulate this planet to take advantage of people who are, you know, just trying to make a living.
Yeah.
Not only in this country, but around the world.
Yeah. Well, I think we all know that certainly goes on at some levels. Now, if you met a lot of these people, and I have met a lot of them, I've worked with them, they would seem to be very upholding citizens, and they love their children. They can be compassionate people. But they've grown up in a system, and they've been to schools. And in fact, you know, what the things I'm talking about here are not illegal. Should be, but they're not. They're sanctioned by the World Trade Organization, NAFTA, all these things. You know, we write the laws. These people can justify that they're not doing anything illegal.
Are they immoral?
I would say they're certainly immoral, and they're very dangerous. the same way that any time empire building happens, it's dangerous. But they're not illegal. And, you know, when I was doing this work, I would lecture at places like Harvard and universities and learning centers around the world on many continents. I was held up as a model. Robert McNamara, president of the World Bank, patted me on the back. What I was doing was not illegal. It should be. If I were a banker and I went to you and I enticed you into accepting a loan that I knew you couldn't repay because I wanted to get a favor from you later on, that would be illegal. I'd be committing a crime. But if it's done on an international level, it isn't. It should be. But so you see, these people can really justify this. I could justify what I was doing. In my heart, I knew it was wrong. But I could go to the textbooks and say that what I was doing was right.
So you're saying, John, basically that they give this money to these banks, and then the banks in turn feed these corporations that send people out to do the work, under the guise of these countries that owe the debt because they're getting the infrastructure done, fully aware that they're not going to be able to pay this back.
Yes. And these debts are taken on by presidents or heads of states of these countries without the support of their people. And I mean, sometimes they're democratically elected, and they may be kicked out of office for doing what's called corrupt. But by the time they've done it, it's too late. And often it's done by dictators who we put into position. So the people of these countries are not taking on this debt, and it's not helping them. It's a few corrupt individuals and families within these countries that's taking on the debt at our urging.
I'm not a supporter. I am not a supporter of Manuel Noriega. He was on the CIA payroll. He was making a lot of money. He was running drugs. God knows how much of this junk got into the United States. However, what I will say is I find it very unusual that he is now tucked away in a prison in this country, and no reporter, including me, can get to this guy to interview him.
Yeah.
And find out what he wants to say. All I know is he didn't play ball, and now he's gone. And I wonder what he knows.
Well, I can share with you what happened there from my perspective. And first of all, I totally agree with you. He was a pretty despicable man.
And first of all, you got to go back a little bit to General Omar, right?
Omar Torrijos. And I'll do that. But before I do, George, I've just been struck by something. When you read those emails that you're getting in, what a wonderful program this is, that you've got such diversity of opinions and thoughts, and how that opens the door to really bringing these two sides together. I think what you're doing is wonderful. It's programs like this that are really going to unite this nation. And again, I think it's unfortunate if somebody leaves the program because they don't like what they first initially hear me saying, because I think, you know, those are exactly the people that I would hope would at least listen, as I hope I will listen to people who I disagree with and maybe change my opinion a little bit, or maybe call in later and attack me, you know, or ask me some very specific questions about things that are bothering them. But I think this is remarkable. I know your show is listened to by many, many, many people across the land.
Well, you've got 5 to 10 million people at any given time.
Yeah. And they obviously represent, you know, a very wide spectrum of opinions. And that's where the healing can really happen in this country. And so my hat's off to you for being able to pull all these people together. I think that's wonderful. Now, shall we? You want
to all right, and be that as it said just a few moments before the top of the hour. The situation, and let's use Panama as an example, because you could basically take this any place around this planet and the scheme would work. But so we had General Omar Torrijos running Panama, and then he decides, right, that he wants to take control of the Panama Canal, which, quite frankly, it's very disappointing to me that we gave that asset up. That was a big mistake, and now the Chinese are controlling it, quite frankly. But be that as it may, he angered a lot of power brokers, did he not?
Well, he certainly did, and the Chinese are not controlling the canal at this point. I mean, the Chinese are having some influence in Panama, but you know that canal, incidentally, over the last 5 years has made twice the profits that it ever made under our operation, and it has the lowest accident rate it's ever had in its history since the 1920s, when there was a lot less cargo. The Panamanians are doing a good job of running that canal, contrary to what many people predicted. Which is not to say that, and I'm not defending that they're owning it or not, but that it's been interesting in the 5 years that they've owned it to see what's happened. The canal's done very, very well for everybody.
I know. I just would have felt a little bit more secure knowing we were there instead of the Chinese.
We've got big forces in San Diego and in Ecuador within minutes reach of the canal. But believe me, we can defend that canal. We have control.
You don't think we would permit anyone to close it, do you?
No.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Anyway, Torrijos is there doing what he does. He gets killed in a plane crash, right?
Well, that's right. And I knew Torrijos. I liked him very much. Very charismatic leader. The history of Panama is that it had been run for 50 years since we'd basically liberated it, as we called it, from Colombia, so we could build a canal. It had been run by oligarchies that were installed by us primarily. There was a coup. Torrijos emerged as the head of state. Very charismatic man. He called me into his little house outside Panama City where he was living at one point. I described this in the book. And he said, you know, I know what you're trying to do here. I know the game you're playing. And I know if I play along, I'll get very, very wealthy. But I'm not interested in that. I really want my poor people to do well. And so I'm not going to play your game. And you can either stay in this country and do something really good for my poor people, or you can get the hell out. And I went back to Boston to my bosses, and we talked about this and decided we might as well stay. You know, maybe we could win him over, and in any case, we could do some good projects there. And here that was part of our business. So, as a matter of fact, we did do some great projects there that helped a lot of peasant farmers and poor fishermen. It showed what good things foreign aid can do. But I was always very concerned because Torrijos was, you know, defying what he was supposed to do. He was not being corrupt.
Let's come back and talk about him and then Manuel Noriega, how he got installed and then kicked out. And then there he is riding away in some prison somewhere. I think he is in Illinois, in a prison there. And I've been wanting to interview him for years. I think he's still alive. I'm not sure. We'll be back in a moment with our guest, John Perkins, with his controversial book, Confessions of an Economic Hitman. I'm George Norrie, and this is Coast to Coast AM.
Miss part of the show? Listen online with Streamlink. Log on to coasttocoastam.com.